colleges and universities here in Wisconsin and around the nation are seeing coronavirus cases rising as fall courses resume. We're talking about it on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The New York Times is tracking cases on campuses. It's counted more than 88,000 cases at more than 1,600 campuses nationwide. Caveats here, not all of these cases are new, and the increase partly stems from schools reporting results from stepped-up COVID testing. Are you a college student? How was your school handling instruction? Are you pleased with what your school's administrators are doing? What do you wish they had done differently? Are you monitoring a dashboard or know the number of infections on your campus? We're at 800-642-1234. Mark Burstein is president of Lawrence University in Appleton. President Burstein, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Kate, thank you so much for having me again. It's a pleasure to be here.
So Lawrence started classes, resumed classes this week, and although the campus reopened, most of these classes are being held virtually. Can you tell us why the university is starting with this model?
Sure. By the way, please call me Mark.
Okay.
So we started planning for the fall, trying to think about what was best for each student as well as each faculty and staff member. And from that vantage point, thinking about their health and also our mission, which is trying to provide an educational environment, we decided to let each member of our community make the decision that's best for them. So we now have about 60% of our students back on campus. 40% of our students decided that distance learning was a better fit for them. From a faculty perspective, about 30% of our classes are taught in person or hybrid, some in person, some through technology, and 70% of our classes are taught from a distance perspective. So we really tried to allow everyone to make the decision that's best for them.
I understand all students and faculty had to be tested before returning to campus. How many positive cases were found, and how did that testing go?
Sure. So the protocol that we had was we asked students before they traveled to campus if they could to find a test and get tested. We asked them also to quarantine, to do a light quarantine. Not all places in the United States or around the world you can get access to testing if you're asymptomatic, so we couldn't require it. Then when they came in, we tested everyone, students, faculty, and staff, and we'll be testing them again 2 weeks later. My two-week test is this morning, so I'm 2 weeks after my first test. We had one student test positive, and four staff members test positive. We also had two staff members who tested positive, not in Lawrence's testing protocol, but outside because they had symptoms. So we now have, actually the student is now out of quarantine, so I'm sorry, out of isolation. So I think we only have four people in isolation right now.
Who are you partnering with to get these tests done?
Yeah, we established a partnership early on with Bellin Health, which is a health system in the Green Bay area. They have a lot of experience doing significant testing in one site because they were the go-to health system for the meatpacking plant issues in Green Bay early on. So they're used to testing a couple hundred people in a day, and that's where we are. We have tested more than 1,400 people now. They searched around for the testing partner, the lab, and that's been a little bit of an odyssey, honestly. There's been less testing capacity in Wisconsin than there was even 5-6 weeks ago, and that has made it hard to find a lab. We're actually using a lab in Indiana right now to process the tests from the campus.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Mark Burstein, who's president of Lawrence University, and we're discussing his university's approach to reopening for fall as COVID is surging on college campuses around the nation. Taking your questions, your insights, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Angie, who's joining us from Beaver Dam this morning. Hi, Angie.
Hello. I have a son at University of Oshkosh, a freshman. When I dropped him off, he was supposed to have a COVID test right away within 24 hours. He could not get that because the app to schedule it was down. And then when it did work, all the testing was full, so he never got a test. He was exposed to COVID about 5 days in, so he had to go get a test immediately. They lost the results. No one could find it, but he was switched to a different dorm to isolate. He had to do it at night. He had to go across campus with all his stuff in the dark. There was no food or drink when he got there. And then he started to have symptoms, which could easily be a cold or allergies. So they moved him to the sick dorm. By then, he had found his results. They were negative. So now he's in the isolated sick dorm, needs to get another test today. It'll take 4 days to get back. The only food they have access to is frozen food in that dorm and then apples and oranges.
Angie, appreciate your call and explaining this situation. Mark, what do you hear here with, a student, a freshman at UW-Oshkosh, and just how the maneuvering is with the testing?
Yeah, that story is very concerning to me. I can't comment on another institution, but that wouldn't be the way we would manage it at Lawrence. The way we worked is that every student got tested before they moved into the residence hall. So we organized that. It wasn't always as smooth as we would have liked it to be, given the volume, but everyone got a test, and also everyone got results within 3 to 4 days. We also provide food directly from our dining services to anyone who's in isolation or quarantine, and we have staff who check in on every student 4 or 5 times a day, sometimes more frequently, if that is needed. So, I think parents should try to expect that kind of level of support for students, given that their health is a prime goal for any institution.
What would you suggest Angie do as a parent in these circumstances and seeing her son just being really jostled around in these first few weeks?
Yeah, I mean, I think that all of us in higher education are really trying to make sure that there's an open line with parents as well as students, given how much needs to change given the pandemic. So I would suggest she contact the chancellor's office or the dean of students office and talk to them about her son's experience and see what their reaction could be.
Thousands of new coronavirus cases continue to emerge on college campuses nationwide. We have Lawrence University President Mark Burstein with his perspective from Appleton and what he sees from fellow college presidents and administrators facing down the pandemic. What do you want to ask a college president in these times? Has your college or university communicated the risks you might face attending classes during a pandemic? Are you a college administrator? What tough choices did you make? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a minute with Lawrence's Mark Burstein here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about COVID-19 outbreaks centered on college campuses and what administrators do next. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Students living in close proximity with one another, residence halls turned into isolation space for dorm residents. Here is Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's leading infectious disease expert, earlier this month. On NBC's Today Show, he urged colleges not to send students home.
Keep them at the university in a place that's sequestered enough from the other students, but don't have them go home because they could be spreading it in their home state.
Are you a parent of a college student? Are you worried for your child's health or worried about them coming home at Thanksgiving? Did you keep them home for a semester? Is your student taking a gap year? It's 800-642-1234. We have Lawrence University President Mark Burstein, who stays with us. Mark, under what circumstances would you send students home?
Yeah, Kate, I agree with Dr. Fauci and also the CDC advice on this, which is we really shouldn't allow a student who is sick, quite honestly sick for any reason, to travel. So we are set up to provide both quarantine. Quarantine space would be for space for someone who came in contact, who had tested positive, but may or may not be positive themselves, or isolation space, which is someone who has tested positive themselves. And we have space for that for our student body. There are exceptions here. You know, if I was a parent living in Wisconsin and I, or drivable Minnesota, Illinois, Iowa, and I had a kid on campus who had COVID, quite honestly, I would want to drive and pick up my child. And in those circumstances, we're not going to say you cannot have your child. But putting a student on public transportation, you know, airplanes or buses or anything like that, really is a real mistake, both for that student as well as for the community as well.
We've received a question by email here. The listener is asking if students at Lawrence are being fined for being in large groups or violating COVID safety rules. Are there clampdowns like that? And the listener had heard of that happening on other campuses.
Yeah, we wouldn't use a fine as a motivator in this situation. What we've tried to do is first educate. We're really all learning these new rules. Certainly I am. When to wear a mask, when I cannot. When 6 feet distance is important. What does symptoms tracking mean? A host of other things. So first, we really try to spend a time with a student, as well as, quite honestly, faculty and staff members, to ensure they really understand these rules and why these rules are really important for them. After that, if someone in our community, again, not only students, but faculty and staff, break those rules over and over again, then we have an adjudication process which levies punishments. Ultimately, for a student, what it would be is saying, I'm sorry, being on campus is not a good fit for you, and we really feel like you should be a distance learner.
Your university has asked everyone who is returning to campus to take a pledge for how to behave during the pandemic. And I was looking at your website, and there is the pledge right there splashed across the page. Can you tell us what this involves?
Sure. One of the aspects of running a college like Lawrence is that we are very community-oriented. And part of the educational process is through community interactions. So the pledge is building off of that, saying that we are each responsible for each other's health, and that means taking certain actions individually to try to ensure the health of every other member of the campus community. So those actions are some of the ones that I mentioned before. We require masks on campus. And, you know, I'm so proud of my community. Right now, folks are really following these rules like masking. The challenge has actually been with residents of the Fox Cities who walk on our campus and are not following the pledge. So we have a little bit of an issue on that front. But wearing masks, 6 feet distance, checking our symptoms every morning, and if we have any symptoms, as that parent said earlier, some of the symptoms could be like having allergies, but we still ask if you have those symptoms, please don't interact with the community during that day, and a host of other requests, suggestions about ways of ensuring that we all stay safe.
Mark Burstein is president of Lawrence University in Appleton. We're talking about Lawrence's approach to reopening for fall as COVID surges on college campuses across the nation. Still time for you at 800-642-1234. Mark, have there been any investments in infrastructure like air filters or automatic doors, other things like that to help prevent spreading the virus?
Absolutely, Kate. And this is a part of the world that I think many folks don't think about, but is an area that those of us who run institutions have had to think very extensively about over the summer. We've changed all of our air filtration systems. Those are the systems that try to clean the air when it's ventilated in a building. We're also investing in an ultraviolet light process that kills bacteria in the air when it's circulated through. We also have put up a significant amount of plexiglass to try to ensure the or inhibit the passing of, we've heard a lot about this, droplets between people. And a host of other changes on campus. So we've really tried to think these things through. And back to a question you asked earlier, why only 30% of our classes are taught in person? For many faculty, when they saw what a classroom would look like socially distant, so 6 feet circle around every chair and all the students masked, they realized that in many cases it would be more effective to teach via technology because everyone could see each other and could interact in a way that a socially distant classroom really wouldn't allow. So that really tipped the balance for many faculty saying, wow, it could be easier for me to teach. I didn't expect that, but it'd be easier for me to teach via Zoom than it would be in a classroom that would set up for social distancing.
When we last spoke back in May, it was about the financial burden the pandemic has been putting on colleges. Has your financial position for Lawrence, has that changed? Has it improved? What is it like?
Yeah, so also a great question, Kate. So we decided to make decisions for the fall term that really met two goals, health of the community and meeting our mission, our educational mission. We didn't take finances into consideration, and we ended up in this place, allowing every member of our community to make the decision that's best for them. It is a significant financial hit for Lawrence, and I think any option for the fall would have been a significant financial hit. We're extraordinarily fortunate that we have a very large endowment. We have over $350 million in an endowment that supports the institution every year, thanks to the generosity of members of the Lawrence community since our founding in 1847. And we are relying on that resource to ensure that we have the funds this year to provide the quality education that we're known for.
What would numbers look like? What is the plan for when in-person instruction could resume in full?
It's a great question, and I apologize, but I do not have an answer for that. We're really trying to take it one term at a time. The information that we have about the virus is changing week by week, so we are trying to adapt our plans every week in response to new information, and we'll have to see. My hope is that we can all get back together again as soon as possible. I would love to even do that in the middle of fall term if we could. But given where we are, and quite honestly, a bigger concern for me is where we are as a state. the virus spread in Appleton and in the Fox Cities is extraordinary right now. Our mayor called it alarming, and I completely agree with him. So, you know, our context, even though the campus context is in relatively good shape, our surrounding community is not. So we have to take that into consideration as well.
Well, Mark, thank you for joining us. Take care.
Thank you, Kate. Pleasure always to be with you.
Mark Burstein is president of Lawrence University in Appleton. Coming up, we talk with the mayor of Kenosha about plans for rebuilding after the damage that occurred during the protests over the police shooting of Jacob Blake. Do you live in Kenosha? Is the city doing enough to address what's happened there? Join in at 800-642-1234. We will be back to check on Kenosha, what happens next after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. You have a line to the mayor of Kenosha here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're examining Kenosha's rebuilding process and the path forward for how the city will heal following the police shooting of Jacob Blake 3 weeks ago. His family led a protest march on Saturday in Milwaukee. Here's Jacob Blake's uncle, Justin Blake, at the rally speaking with WITI-TV.
We want justice. We want indictment. And we want a conviction now, not just for little Jake, for all the little Jakes around this country and around this world.
How do you want to see Kenosha respond and rebuild in the aftermath of this police shooting? Join in at 800-642-1234. John Anoramian is mayor of Kenosha. Mayor Anoramian, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, explain the plans you're laying out for Kenosha to form committees that will examine the issue of racism. Can you explain these committees?
Sure. First off, before we even get to committees, the first piece of what we're doing is what we announced yesterday, our hearing sessions. So we are having hearing sessions over the next month so that people can come. We're working with the Department of Justice. They are going to help run the hearing sessions, of which case I and the chief or deputy chief will be there. And then the public will be able to come in and talk to us as to what they are seeing as the issues before the community. The first thing you have to do before you start trying to come up with different ways of changing things is to make sure that you understand what the changes that our people are looking for need to be.
What is the role of the Justice Department in these listening sessions?
They are going to manage the listening sessions, so they are going to run them, so that it is not the city that's running the listening sessions. It's Department of Justice, the community relations aspect of the Department of Justice out of Chicago.
How will these listening sessions be structured? I mean, how will people give input? Will there be questions asked? How do you run these?
The Department of Justice has put together a number of questions for people to respond to. And they'll be given a list of those questions, and people will be given an opportunity to talk on any one of the issues that they wish to speak on. And that is how we'll try to make sure that we can hone in on the different issues that we need to address. The material then will be put together. It'll also be done online, so people who may not be able to get to the meetings or unable to speak at the meetings because we still have to deal with COVID and the process for that. We'll get that information. And then the committees that we are looking to form through the clergy, which has been a huge help in putting this together. In fact, they basically came on early prior to the Jacob Blake situation shooting. They came on early with the George Floyd issue. Once George Floyd was killed, the city, I approached the clergy and ask them to help. And so a couple of months ago, we started the process. So that is basically the concept that we've been following. working with the clergy, putting together a, in a sense, a roadmap to action as to how we're going to do things. And that has been worked on now for a while. So that'll then be kicking in after the issue comes down to of dealing with the public meetings.
Who will be on these committees and what power will they have?
The committees will be a group that will be from all over. There'll be young, old, all walks of life, all racial issues or all different individuals. All of that will be put together. And the committees basically are going to be in the area of police and community relationships. The other areas will be employment, justice, and one of the areas that I think is a huge issue, of course, education, but one of the issues that I think is something that has to be looked at also is mental health and how this country is dealing with that issue also. So all those are areas that committees will be put together, and those committees will start looking at what's going on. And I think it's important that when we look at what we're doing, that we don't look at this in the sense of, okay, we have these committees, they've come up with recommendations, the city has implemented a number of the recommendations, and now we're done. That is a mistake if we do that. What needs to happen is these committees need to continue to review and continue to look at what we're doing and how we're doing things. So I look at these committees as long-term committees, not short-term.
This is a continual process of reflection and action. I'm wondering, Mayor, when going back to mental health, you see as such a big issue. What do you mean by that?
I think when you look at what has occurred in the mental health area in this country, we have been, I think, two areas that really have been terribly funded and we just haven't done a good job on, has been mental health and our youth, and our young people, making sure that they have a belief that there is a better life, that there is opportunity for them. And I think that the two areas that I think need to really be looked at, stressed on, is mental health issues in this country in general. Because I don't think we've just done a very good job in the sense of dealing with homeless and people with mental health issues, and just the whole process has not been handled well. And I think the other area that we've not handled well also goes off into the youth. But those are issues that I think are important that we also have to look at. Right now, the issue before us is going to be dealing with racism and how racism impacts your community. And racism impacts all these things.
We're talking with John Antaramian, who is the mayor of Kenosha. We're talking about the city's plans to rebuild and heal after the unrest sparked by the police shooting of Jacob Blake last month. You can join in with your questions. What do you want to ask the mayor of Kenosha? Do you live in the city? Is the city doing enough to address what has happened there? We're at 800-642-1234. Mayor, as you form this roadmap, the word that you've used there, and work through these committees and work through their strategies, where are your milestones and benchmarks for how you're doing? How will you reflect on if you're actually making change?
I think the issue of making change, number one, is going to be what do the committees come up with as to modifications that we need to make, looking at training, looking at different aspects of what we're doing, and looking at those as benchmarks to start with. The long-term benchmarks really are how as a community we recover and how as a community we deal with the racial issues that we have. I don't know that you're going to say there's a specific benchmark that solves a problem. It doesn't. It's going to be a continuous changing of benchmarks. It's going to be a continuous changing of where we are and what we're doing. So can you look at, let's do law enforcement. Will you look at community relations with the police department? What do we do to make those changes? And the benchmark really comes down to is, did we make the change? Are we seeing a better relationship between police and the community? When you look at benchmarks in the sense of whether mental health, did we actually succeed in providing, getting a hospital to actually open up a mental health facility in Kenosha? Those are benchmarks that we can shoot for and that we can then show and say, yes, we've accomplished certain things. But I think that really in the end becomes what it is. And as I tell everyone, in the end, the responsible party is me. So I look at this in the sense of what are we going to do to make Kenosha a better place and then start implementing things that come out of the committees.
Let's take a look at your damaged businesses and business owners saying they want to see action now. They want rebuilding to happen sooner than later. There's not time to talk and meetings. They need to start seeing the rebuilding process. What would you say to those business owners?
Well, there are a number of things that we've been pushing for. City immediately requested $30 million from the state and federal government, of which $1 million has now been sent from the state as loans. And they have been running that through, I believe, CABA, which is an economic development arm of the community. The president promised $4 million. We have not seen that yet. But when that comes through, hopefully, that will then also be given through CAPA, is my understanding. But part of that is waiting for that. So the other part is that the city has been making requests to the state and federal government on a continuous basis to try to get the businesses some help as to what's going on. So everyone is pushing as to getting the state and feds to help out on this. Plus, we've been working with the DNR and others, because when you have property that has to be removed, there's a number of DNR issues, and DNR has been very helpful with us in working with the community or working with the businesses to try to help them. But literally at this point in time, we're pushing for the state and federal government to help us with the finances to help these businesses rebuild. We're working on trying to get some insurance commissioner down here to talk to the individuals who are having any trouble with their insurance companies. So we're trying to do everything we can on that basis to move forward for the business community.
Do you see any timelines there for getting these funds from the state and the feds? What have they told you?
Well, the state has came down very quickly, and my understanding, with their $1 million for the loans. The federal government, we're pushing on our congressman at this point in time to find out when those funds will be coming. There was $1 million, but that the first $1 million that the feds are sending definitely dealt with other issues, not dealing with the economics. But again, we're pushing on the state and federal governments as hard as we can to get them to help out in this situation.
Will Kenosha businesses bounce back from this?
Yes, I believe. I think you'll find Kenosha not only will bounce back from this, but will bounce back stronger. I think that too often everyone looks at the negatives, and we have negatives. I'm not going to sit here and say everything's working perfectly. It's not. We have an issue. We have a problem, and we're going to have to deal with it. But as we deal with it, it's also important for us to understand this is a resilient community and a lot of really good people in this community. And the people in this community have done a good job in the sense of trying to support and rebuild, and that's everybody. So I'm looking at this from the perspective that we will come back, and we will come back stronger.
We have Kenosha Mayor John Antaramian discussing his city's plans to rebuild, to come back, confront systemic racism after the police shooting of Jacob Blake last month. You can join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Kenosha Mayor John Antaramian. He announced efforts to rebuild the city, start community conversations around policing and criminal justice, employment, education, mental health, young people. But will these committee efforts, will they be able to get to the heart of the matter and the issues of racism? 800-642-1234. Let's bring in John now, joining us from Madison. Hi, John. What's your question?
Hi. My question for the mayor is, what freedom does a municipality like Kenosha have to change the structure of their police force? For an example, Britain's model is to have constables do things like ticketing and other nonviolent offenses, and then they have special forces that come in and work with more violent situations. What freedom does a city like Kenosha have to implement something like that?
Actually, cities have a fair amount of authority to determine how their policing occurs. So an example, there is a CSOs, I think they're called, in the city, which basically deal with ticketing and different types of activities that are within the community. But they are not; they don't do confrontational type of things or involvement in that, but just the general type of activity. So there's ways of doing different things. What you're talking about is a little more of a community policing concept with law enforcement. So the cities do have that ability to make those changes as to how they want to handle and manage their community.
John and Madison, thank you for the call. Mayor, you plan to work with the Common Council to budget for police training. What would this training look like? What's the plan there?
And actually, that's one of those things that what I've done is, as I put budgets together, which are happening now, I've added funds into training, but I've not specified how that training is going to be used. What I want to do is, as we go through the process and we do the reviews of our policies, procedures, what we're doing, that will then determine what funding, where that funding should go. You know, for me just to say we're going to put it here or here, then we're not listening to what people have to say. We need to make sure we have an understanding of perception. We also need to have an understanding of what it is we're actually, and you know, what training we are doing now that maybe needs to be modified. So that's what I'm doing, is putting the funds available, making sure the funds are available for that process. Can I just, there's one other area I really think
I'm
touching on, because I think it's important. Wisconsin changed its law a number of years ago dealing with investigation of these types of situations and shootings. And the way it sets up, because I think a lot of people seem to think that the city is investigating itself. It is not. Once a shooting occurs, it is transferred over to the state, and the state attorney general is the entity now that has control of the investigation. So the city of Kenosha does not do any investigation of their own. The state comes in. They are now doing the investigation. When the state is done with their investigation, they will turn over all the information to the district attorney. And then the district attorney will make filing charges, or whatever they're going to do comes from the district attorney's office. So the city is not involved in any of the investigation going on in the Jacob Blake shooting. And I just want to make sure that's out there, because I think a lot of people think that the community itself is doing the investigation, and we are not.
Attorney General Josh Collis said that he wants to make sure that the investigative process is transparent. And that the public knows what is going on. How do you see in your role in the city and as mayor in improving transparency on what is going on in this investigation?
Well, that is difficult for us to do, because it really is in the Attorney General's hand. We have no information on the investigation at all, and that's the way it's supposed to be. So I think Josh Paul is going to be the one who's going to have to make sure that any clarification, all the information, that whatever is going to come out will be coming out through them.
If you're just joining us, we have Kenosha Mayor John Antaramian with us as we look ahead at the city's next steps toward rebuilding, toward healing after the unrest that was sparked by the police shooting of Jacob Blake last month. Taking your calls, your questions for the mayor at 800-642-1234. Mayor, you're also planning to move up funding for body cameras to next year instead of 2022. What are you hoping to accomplish with that move?
Well, I think that a lot of people have been concerned about the timing of body cams and feeling that they need to be moved up. The council has informed me that they also believe that strongly. So what we're doing is we're moving up the time frame. There's still a couple of things that we would like to see some modifications made from on the state level, but there are issues that prior to this were problematic in the sense of how long you had to keep tapes and everything else. So the state did make some modifications, which makes it easier, and that was part of why the city had been waiting for those modifications prior to moving up on body cams. So we will be doing the body cams next year. We'll be doing the increase in training. And there is some money that is going to be placed into the budget for some more community policing concepts and beat patrol type of things.
Why haven't body cams been worn sooner in Kenosha?
Well, partly because the state just changed the law about a year ago, dealing with timing and how long you can keep the tapes. There are some questions that have been raised about personal. Whenever you have body cams, the question comes down to is people's homes that police officers go into and the taping, and that all becomes public record. And so there are some issues that the cities have had concern about. The state did resolve some of those, and so that's why body cams are moving up at this point in time.
Let's bring in Hattie now in Madison. Hi, Hattie.
Hi, good morning. Yeah, I just wanted to ask, why are we doing all these or trying to do all these changes today? Did the mayor know what was going on before? Why didn't he take steps before we got to this point today?
Actually, that's a good question, and we did. We started the process prior to the situation occurring by bringing the clergy in after the George Floyd death. And we basically started working on it at that point in time because we saw what was going on in the community and other places, and we wanted to make sure that we got ahead of this whole situation in the sense of how we're going to deal with racism in the communities. So we attempted to get things started and literally did have things started down that road. So that was the intention, and we, as I said, had been working with the clergy. I have been meeting with the clergy basically for the last 4 years, every quarter. And so as the situation, the killing of George Floyd in Minnesota happened, I immediately pulled the clergy together and said, where do we go? How do we start to put together some things to look at what's going on in our community and what we can do to try to improve it? So we did attempt to get that started earlier.
What do the clergy members in Kenosha tell you today?
Well, we met the other, if you saw the press conference the other day, the clergy was with me at the podium, and they basically are in favor of moving forward and working with the city to help work through our problems and working with the community. So I think that the clergy has been very helpful on that basis, and I appreciate all the hard work that they're doing to try to improve the community. And I feel very confident that they will be there through the whole process, and we will make change, and we will be a better community for it.
Mayor, in the last few seconds we have with you, what is keeping you up at night? What is the most difficult thing you have to grapple with right now?
The most difficult thing is you have one young man who's been shot, and again, we'll find out the information on that shortly as to from the state. I have two young men dead, and I have a third young man who is severely wounded. I think that keeps me up at night probably more than anything else.
Mayor, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
John Antaramian is the mayor of Kenosha. Just ahead, we talk with a law professor about a scenario in which President Trump refuses to accept the outcome of the November 3rd election. Would our country face a constitutional crisis? The book is called Will He Go? I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. We'll be right back.